Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and today we're talking with John Hamer. He is a partner at the law firm of Rudman & Winchell in Bangor, Maine. We'll be talking about top 10 employment-related mistakes. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, Rudman & Winchell does a lot of different practice areas. What is your area of practice under in the firm today?
Well, I work in a couple of different areas. I work in labor and employment, and also I do a lot of work in the municipal world, which really involves quite a bit of labor and employment from that perspective as well.
So when you're working in the areas, do you cover the whole state of Maine, or are you particularly in the Bangor area?
Well, we're predominantly in the Bangor area, but we've got clients across the state. To some extent, it depends on how far they want us to travel, and there's a lot of work that we can do from our office without actually having to physically be there.
Great. Well, you know, we're going to be talking about today top 10 employment-related mistakes, which you've provided to us, and I think we'll go through them. But just in an overall general capacity, what do you think is the biggest mistake employers make out there today?
One of the most difficult things, I think, for employers to do is to stay neutral. And by neutral, I mean not get emotionally involved in these employment decisions, because that will get you into trouble every time. And it's probably something that is unavoidable, because people are human and employment situations are extremely personal.
Well, there's no question you have a vested interest in the people that you hire, right? You have a vested interest in your organization, especially if you're an owner or a senior leader. Your employer or your organization is a big piece of who you are, and you can take it personally. There's no question about that.
Especially when you have governmental entities saying you have to do something this way. This is a law that applies to you whether you like it or not. And it can be very difficult to keep track of everything as well.
Well, you working with a lot of municipalities, you also have the added part of unions, right? And that creates a little bit more sometimes of an added layer of challenge.
It certainly does.
So when you're looking at these 10 mistakes that we're talking about today, we're going to start with number one. Using an employment application can be the basis for a discrimination claim. Why is that the case?
Well, of course, your application form is your very first contact with the individual. And before the individual is hired, there are certain things that you just don't want to know. And if you ask them, you can be in trouble right off the bat. So that's why you want to make sure that your employment application doesn't ask for information that can be used against you, even if you don't hire the person.
So some of those things might be age, date of birth, birthplace, medical information, prior arrests, even though I want to talk about that a little bit, religion and national origin and marital status, or, you know, if you're planning to be having children. One of the things in your list is prior arrests. Now, there, I know, has been a movement across the country about check the box, right, or remove the box. Tell me why prior arrests, why can't somebody's arrest record, especially if they've been found guilty, be something that an employer can't really ask about?
Well, I'll make a distinction there for you. First off, this is talking about arrests as opposed to convictions. Convictions are a different story. Arrest means that you've been arrested and you haven't necessarily been convicted of anything yet. And so there are two reasons why you don't want to have that information. The first is, under our system of law, you're innocent until found guilty. So to some extent, you don't want to be making presumptions about how that case is going to come out. The more legally based reason for not using prior arrest information is that there are plenty of studies out there that say that African Americans are arrested more often than other folks. And so that can the use of that information can be the basis of a discrimination claim because you're taking potentially tainted information.
When you're looking at convictions, should this be done by a third party? Should it be done by the organization? How do you, you know, protect yourself in terms of making sure that that information asked for on an application, especially if it's in a conviction way, how do you separate yourself from that?
Frankly, I think the best thing to do is if the person indicates they have been convicted of a crime, is you want to talk to that person and get the information from them. You could go and look up conviction records, but that's going to tell you a lot less than the individual can. You want to probably find out, you know, what was the offense, were there any mitigating circumstances, how long ago was it, things like that, whether this is going to impact their performance in their job. Partially depends on what they're being interviewed for.
You talk about what should be on an application: former employers, supervisors, dates employed, references, obviously convictions, a specific job sought, whether you previously employed the applicant. What are some other things that you're looking at that say, hey, the application, make sure, can it have Social Security numbers? Should it have any identifiable information on it today at all?
It's a good idea to ask the person their name. You want to be able to identify them for sure. But what you really want to have is the information that's going to help you evaluate the candidate to make sure that they're a good fit for your organization. So you really want to make sure, theoretically at least, that the information that will help you assess their abilities for the job sought, that's really what you're after. Everything else is nice. You don't really necessarily care where they live, but you need to have that information. You don't necessarily have to have a lot of other information.
The authorization part, what are you authorizing the employer to do?
Well, it's a good idea to have an authorization to make sure that the applicant understands and agrees that you are permitted to contact references, prior employers. If you're going to do any kind of a criminal background check, then you would need the person's Social Security number. And you want to get authorization to do that as well.
Would a separate authorization form be better, or is it okay to have it all in one?
I think you could. I think it's probably just as well to have it all in one. I think you could do it separately. You just don't want to forget it. As long as it's done, it doesn't matter to me if it's on one piece of paper or two.
Okay. Well, I think that, I mean, obviously application is a staple, but there are some employers that just say, well, no, we go by the resume. We go by, you know, some information they provide us there. So what is it that makes it that if they don't have an employment application that they can actually be discriminated against?
Well, a person can claim discrimination if an employment decision is made on the basis of a protected classification by statute. In Maine, you've got the Maine Human Rights Act that includes a whole bunch of different things, pretty much the same sort of things you'll see in the federal law, but those are things like birthplace, age, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, all those types of factors. If you're asking questions about that type of information or if it's being voluntarily provided to you and you comment upon it excessively and you make an employment decision based on that, even if you don't, as long as the applicant thinks that you have, then you've set yourself up for a suit.
All right, the second one you talk about is failing to conduct adequate and appropriate background checks. Talk to me about references.
Well, references, I think, need to be taken a bit with a grain of salt. These are individuals that the candidate has suggests that you talk to make sure that you've got a third-party evaluation of the candidate. So you're going to have positive people named generally, but those folks are going to provide some potentially good information for you. So it's certainly a good idea to check references, to make sure that they're real people and not just paper people. But one of the things that you want to make sure that when you are talking to them, that you don't ask them things that you can't ask of the applicant directly. So if you're not allowed to ask the person's age directly, you don't want to ask a reference, what is this person's age? It gets you in the same sort of trouble.
So when you're talking about references, can you ask for other people that they haven't put on the list? If you know somebody at that organization, is that okay to go out and do someone outside of their list for a reference?
I think as long as you let the person know that you may be contacting other people, the real question is this going to provide you with any useful information? If it will, and you've let the individual know that you may be contacting other people, I think it's fair to say, I will be contacting such and such. But then I don't see a problem with that.
So, you know, today there is this issue that employers have that they say, hey, look, I'll call references, but I know they're going to give me name, rank, and serial number, basically meaning they're going to tell me, yes, they worked here from employment time to employment time, and, hey, they also made about $10 an hour. But they're not going to tell me anything else. Is there a way for employers to, and of course this becomes a problem when employers have employees that didn't particularly work well, and it's not good for the new employer to not get some information. How do you stand on all that?
Well, that can be difficult. You can't make them talk if they don't want to, and certainly a prior employer may be reluctant to talk or maybe unable to talk if the person left under a situation where they have a separation agreement and they're prohibited from talking. One way around that would be to ask the applicant to maybe provide you the last several evaluations, if they do evaluations, or you know, information from the personnel file that may be useful from that perspective. Not just necessarily the evaluations, but any other positive records that they want to provide or discipline, things like that, you can potentially obtain and review it directly.
Can employers be held liable if they provide information that is, well, you might say, telling the truth about an employee who might have stolen or might have taken who wasn't, hey, just a, that wasn't a good employee? Can they get in trouble for actually saying something that's true?
Certainly there can be trouble, but it doesn't mean that in the end that they would be held liable. Certainly if an employer gives a bad evaluation of an outgoing employee and the employee finds out, they may try to cause troubles. No, I think in the end, as long as the employer is reporting in good faith, it's not going to come back and have them held liable for it. But there's a natural reluctance there to say bad things about people.
All right, so then there's criminal checks, you know, driving checks, credit checks. What are some of the things that you would say are important to know about doing those to keep employers out of trouble?
Well, if you're going to do a criminal background check or a driving check and you do it yourself, then you just need to make sure that you are letting the person know that you're going to be doing these checks and use the information appropriately. If you're going to go to a third party to do the background check, then there may be some federal Fair Credit Reporting Act issues to work through, probably more on the part of the reporting agency as compared to the actual employer. But in the end, what you're looking for is information that's going to help you evaluate the employee and determine whether they're appropriate for the job. So if the person doesn't actually drive for work, then maybe you don't necessarily need to do the motor vehicle check. Or conversely, if they're going to be driving a lot, then you want to make sure for sure that they've got a good driving record and definitely check that.
You know, there are some drug checks that are out there right now in terms of drug testing here in Maine. And I know there's certainly been some changes in the last year or two having to do with, you know, doing it from a federal standard or doing it from a state standard. Do you have any opinion on what employers should really be looking at in terms of making sure that they do drug testing properly?
That is worth an entire hour's worth of discussion alone. You can't just go out and drug test an applicant or an employee. You have to have policies in place. There's often have to be approved by the state. So unless you really need to have it because of state requirements, it's probably best avoided, frankly.
When you're talking about hiring an employee, and let's say that you haven't done a background check, you haven't done references, you just hire them, and something happens, and then an employee goes out and does something that maybe injures another employee, and then it's found out that person had a history of doing something wrong, and it wasn't found because you didn't do your due diligence. Tell me how an employer could be held liable for that in terms of either negligence or something to that aspect.
Sure. There is a tort called negligent hire or negligent retention, and the point of the tort is to allow people to recover in situations where a person is hired where the employer could have found out that the person is dangerous or unfit for the position. And if you don't take the time to do the background check and you willfully or intentionally look the other way and you hire this person and then they go out and harm somebody, then that's negligence on your part.
Do you see that this is the same in terms of sex offenders or anything in that aspect which might be public record but you haven't checked into it?
Well, sex offenders on a sex registry, certainly that's going to be somewhat available, and I'm not sure if it's the conviction would come up, and so you would have that information there. The first thing you need to do is really take a look at what the position, what kind of contact is the person going to have with the public. If the person's going to be having very limited contact and be working in the office, then you're going to do one kind of background check for that person, as opposed to perhaps a person who's going to be going from home to home and doing sales or installation or something that has a lot of contact with the public. In that case, you're going to need to take a much closer look at the person to make sure that their background is clear and that they're safe to put in those situations. So that's the first thing you need to do, is to find out or decide what this person is going to do and then find out how much investigation you need to do. Once you've done that, presuming that the person's going to be having high contact with the public, then you want to look at a variety of sources. You want to make sure that there's no outstanding convictions for felony assault. Anything like that would be a red flag. Certainly any sort of sex offense would be a red flag. And maybe the driving record would show some problems about having them on the road. Once you get all that information together, you probably want to pull the person aside and say, gee, can you explain these? Is there any information that you need to add? And then make your decision based on all of those facts. If it comes back that the person has been convicted of assault, then it probably doesn't matter so much what they're going to say, but it's still a good idea to give them opportunity to respond to information that you've discovered before you use it.
So I just want to be clear, it is okay to do different background checks for different people in the same organization and not have it as a blanket policy across that we're going to do, you know, a standard background check for everyone?
I'm going to say yes and no. And the reason is you want to do have a standard policy per position or per category of employee. You don't want to decide, I'm going to do a background check on you because you look like you might be trouble and not you, even though you're applying for the same position. So if you're going to have a category of positions, have them all be investigated the same.
We're talking with John Hamer. He is the partner with the law firm of Rudman & Winchell. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking with John Hamer. He is a partner with the law firm of Rudman & Winchell, a great sponsor of the HR Power Hour. And we're talking about top 10 employment-related mistakes. We talked about the first two, using an employment application, which can be the basis for a discrimination claim. And number two, failing to conduct adequate and appropriate background checks. Our third, John, is about failing to have an employee handbook and failing to obtain employee acknowledgement of receipt of a handbook. Why is that so important?
Well, first off, let me just put out there that it's not absolutely required that you have an employee handbook, but if you do have one, that these are very important steps to take. And frankly, it's a good idea to have one, because this is your method to have some good communication with your employees, to make sure that everyone understands what it is that they should be doing and how they should be doing it, and if there's a problem, what to do then. So having a handbook allows you to communicate well and to help streamline your employment relationship. So if you do have a personnel policy, first off, let me say that it's important to have certain things addressed in there. You want to have an equal employment opportunity statement, a statement that the employment is at will, if it is at will. They state your policies against sexual harassment, who to contact, and other types of policies such as that, which are going to be extremely important to protect the employer in the event problems do arise, and to help the employees understand how to address problems if they do arise as well. So having an employment handbook is a good idea, I think. But it doesn't help unless it's properly distributed. So if you have a handbook, you want to make sure that people receive a copy of the handbook, and if there are updates, that they receive copies of the updates. So it's one thing to have a personal policy that's on your computer somewhere. People may or may not see it there. So you probably want to make sure that it's physically distributed so that the person can take a look at the paper copy. And once they have it, then you can have them sign off that they've actually received it and that they understand it. And if they don't understand it, this is how you get clarification. This is who you talk to. Because a lot of law is about documentation. And if you don't do that, then there could be a dispute down the road that, gee, well, I never saw a copy of the personnel policy. Or if they saw it, I never understood it. It was never explained to me. Having a simple acknowledgement form can clear all that up and avoid these kind of problems.
Well, you talked about the acknowledgement form, and that goes in the personnel file, correct?
Yes. You want to keep a copy of that in the personnel file, and it would be very simple, basically saying you acknowledge receipt of the personnel file, you've had the opportunity to read it and ask questions, and then you understand it.
Well, that takes us right into number four, when we're talking about the top 10 employment-related mistakes. And number four is failure to maintain appropriate personnel files. Well, we all know that personnel files are really important, and we certainly have had some guests on our show that have talked about different ways to set them up and make sure that they're set up properly. Why is it so important to really maintain these over a long period of time? I mean, people say, well, they just sit there. Why is it so important?
I will tell you that these points may be in order, and this may be our fourth point, but I'm not necessarily going to agree that it's fourth in terms of importance. Personnel files are extremely important, and they can get you into trouble very easily. From a long-term employment perspective, you need to have a personnel file so that you can keep track of the employment relationship from start to finish. I mean, one of the very first things you're going to have in your personnel file is going to be the employment application, and it's going to go right from that point all the way up to the time the person resigns, is fired, retires, or whatever, and then probably even after that. If it's not in the personnel file, then there's an argument that legally it didn't happen. Now, we all know that's not correct, but documentation. The whole point is to be able to document, to show what has happened, when it happened, and what happened. So personal files is your way of doing that. It's the person's workbook. I would say life book, but it's their work life book. How's that?
Well, you know, and this can be done electronically today, correct? It doesn't necessarily have to be a paper file anymore.
That's right. And there's one huge common misconception is that a personnel file is actually, you know, a manila folder that's held in a filing cabinet somewhere. It's not. A personnel file is a concept. It's basically all documents that relate to the character and performance of that employee, regardless of what form it's in or where it's kept.
So someone could obviously have records in one's laptop, one's computer, could have the HR file. I mean, there's a lot of different pieces to this. What are some of the risks employers take from a fine perspective in terms of not having them correctly, you know, filed properly?
Well, certainly there are some parts of the personnel file which are required to be kept separate and under lock and key. Medical records, for example. You don't want to have those inadvertently leak to other parties. Personnel files are to be kept confidential in general as well, but certain portions are more confidential than others, I guess I'll call it. In terms of things that can get you into trouble with them if you don't have them properly documented, well, one of the essential elements of a personnel file is a person's I-9. I don't do immigration law, but I know that you need to have one, and you need to be able to produce it upon request in the event that Customs and Immigration asks for it. And if you don't, there's going to be trouble there.
So when somebody looks at an I-9 or they're looking at any employee files, I guess one thing that employers always ask is, you know, what does an employee have the right to see?
The employee has the right to see their entire personnel file. Not only do they have the right to see it, upon request, they have the right to get a copy of it. And basically that, in Maine, that's going to be a copy paid for by the employer once a year. And if there's updates, they get a copy of the updates that occurred every time, once per year as well.
So an employee file is now in place. How long does an employer have to keep it, or are there different parts that have to be kept for different areas? I think I know the answer, but I'm just making sure that nothing's changed recently.
Well, I'm going to say that you're going to keep it a good long time, and it partially depends on who you are. If you're a public employer, you're going to be holding that personnel file for, I believe, the current rate in Maine is 60 years after the time the person leaves employment. So a very, very long time. If you're a private employer, you're going to need to keep it for a specified period of time. And that's going to, I'm not sure there's an actual set deadline, but it's going to be long enough to make sure that the person, if he needs it in the future, will be able to have access to it.
So the number fifth one you have in terms of the top 10 employment-related mistakes is failing to follow disciplinary and termination policies. I think it's self-explanatory that if you have a disciplinary termination policy, you should follow it. Why would employers not want to do that, or why would there be a risk if they don't? Because, you know, they'll say, and I've heard it, each circumstance is different.
That's true. Each circumstance is different, but it partially depends on what your policy is. If you've got a disciplinary procedure and you don't follow it for one person and you follow it for everybody else, then you're treating this person differently, and there's going to be a potential discrimination claim. They'll find some protected category to say it's because of this category and it's not actually true discipline. Or if your disciplinary policy says that you're going to use progressive discipline and then you fire a person the first time they do something wrong and never gave them the opportunity to correct the behavior, or maybe never even informed them what they were doing wrong, that's going to be a problem as well. They're going to come back and question why you've done that. When you're talking about at-will employees, you know, there's no expectation or right to continue to work. That's certainly at the will of the employer and the employee, but you still can't terminate somebody for improper reasons or discriminatory reasons.
So when somebody has, there can be, of course, I should say, a level right to discipline. In other words, if something is so outrageous that it might get someone terminated. On the other hand, it might be, you know, minimal in nature and only be a verbal or written warning. So there are degrees to this, correct?
Yes, there are. And certainly if someone's going to be looking at a suspension, that's much less serious than a termination and a warning versus a suspension. So there are definitely levels of discipline that can be used. And how important it is to follow the rules, I think you need to follow them equally in every case, because you never know where you're going to end up. So if you've got a disciplinary policy that says the person will have the right to, you know, to defend themselves and to provide an explanation as to why what they did wasn't so bad, you don't necessarily know what the outcome will be until you've heard from them, so you need to follow that procedure every time.
Do you have an example, maybe, of an employer who really maybe learned the hard way in terms of understanding the importance of making sure that disciplinary policy is consistent across the board?
Well, I do a lot of work in the public sector, and you know, I've seen on many different occasions where, in unionized context, where discipline is either overturned or reduced, and that makes it very difficult to run your business when you're constantly having to fight these battles. So I can't point to you a specific case or anything like that, but it's a regular occurrence in the unionized and the municipal world where if you don't follow the procedure correctly, you're looking at having your actions either nullified or reduced and paying a lot of money to get to that point, because defending these cases, it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort.
You know, collective bargaining is certainly, union contracts and so forth sometimes spell out, or most of them spell out, the policies and procedures that organizations have to go through, and they sometimes may or may not conflict with the procedure or policy that the company has placed for its non-union workers. Do you find that it is best to try to mirror those two, or is it okay still to have differences between the union agreement and maybe the non-union policies and procedures?
Well, I don't think that there's a problem about having different procedures as long as you know what they are and are able to keep track of them. It may be that you've got more than one union, so you're going to have negotiated contracts, and those contracts may start the same and end up in a very different place. And if you've got non-unionized employees as well, you're going to have them going to a third place. So certainly uniformity would be helpful, but as long as you can keep track of each class of employees, just go back to the written document, read it each time, because you want to make sure you don't miss anything.
We're talking with John Hamer. He is the partner with the law firm of Rudman & Winchell. We're talking about the top 10 employment-related mistakes employers make. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
If you'd like to be a guest on the HR Power Hour or be a show sponsor, send David an email today at info@hrpowerhour.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by cmacareer.com. Today we're talking with John Hamer. He is a partner with the law firm of Rudman & Winchell, and we're talking about top 10 employment-related mistakes. John, we've got through about five or six so far. Actually, we're going into number six right now, which is violating employees' rights after termination. John, I've terminated them. What rights could they possibly have?
You know, sometimes people just hang around and they just won't go away. And that certainly is the case in a lot of employment cases. When an employee separates from employment, they still have certain statutory rights and you have certain statutory obligations. The first of which is that the employee has the right to request, at least in Maine, written reasons for the termination. And the employer has a duty to provide those within a certain time frame, and if you don't, violation of law. Worse than not responding is responding inappropriately. And by inappropriately, I mean if you are going to let somebody go and you've got a good reason for doing it, you need to actually say what that reason is and not make up other things. I think that when you get to the time where separation is necessary and you have to fire somebody, then emotions tend to be high, and sometimes the tendency is to try to throw all the reasons at the person. You know, back in 1983, you did this, that, and the other thing, and that is actually digging a hole for yourself. If you really fired the person for a specific reason, you know, you just did a terrible job on the presentation and, you know, you lost us as client and I know you feel bad about it, but that's what happened and that's why you're being fired, then you need to say that. Because the moment you deviate from that real bona fide reason for terminating the person, you're going to be opening yourself up to potential problems later on. The employee's going to say, gee, you know, I never knew that thing I did in 1983 was a problem, and now here it is. Or you never told me that, something I did last week was a problem, and I never had the chance to defend myself. And so there are all kinds of reasons why you want to make sure that you provide those in a timely manner and in an accurate manner.
Employers also have to be careful about making sure that they pay the final paycheck on time, correct? And that they make sure that if there's anything out there that has to be paid having to do with, like, earned vacation time in the state of Maine, that's an important aspect to make sure it gets out paid on the right time, correct?
Extremely important. And if you don't make all the timely payments or you don't pay all the accrued work time and accrued vacation time, you can be sued and you could be ending up paying a penalty in addition to their attorney's fees for collecting those. So there's certainly a statute in place that requires that when a person separates from employment, you have to pay them within a reasonable period of time after demand. And if you don't do that, then you're going down the road of litigation. And those claims can be very easy to avoid by understanding what's payable and by making those payments. But even then, there may be disagreements over maybe someone's on commission and whether those commission payments are payable now or if the person leaves employment and then they are paid, whether the person's entitled to that or not. So it's not always that clear, but in most cases, if you've got accrued and vacation time that you could have taken on the day of your termination, those have to be paid out as part of your wages. And if you don't, you'll be paying for it in the long run.
The seventh one in terms of the top 10 employment-related mistakes is responding to claims from unemployment. What are some of the big downfalls of making sure that you don't respond fast enough? Or what if you just say, look, I'm not going to find unemployment, let it go?
Well, actually, not fighting unemployment is probably the least of your problems. If you're self-insured, and you may end up paying some money for it, but if you don't contest, you're probably not going to have any problem with that employee in the future. The problems arise when you do contest an unemployment claim. In that case, you may be looking at having some administrative hearings, and in those hearings, that employee may bring their attorney and may be questioning you about what happened and why they were terminated, and they may be building a case against you without you even realizing it. So it's important to understand the purpose of unemployment and the situation where a person would be able to get unemployment versus not, so you can decide whether it's worth it to actually contest unemployment.
When you're talking about making sure that that you have counsel, do the employers have a right to bring in counsel if necessary?
in an unemployment hearing, yes, they would. Oh. There are a couple different stages of unemployment. The first is a fact-finding. If you've contested an unemployment claim, you'll get a call from an investigator. They'll talk to each party separately first, and then they'll make their findings. At that point, if the unemployment is awarded and the employer objects and they file an appeal, they'll go to a hearing. And at that point, the employee is potentially going to bring their employee and maybe questioning you under oath. And those statements that you make will be around to haunt you forever. And you may not even realize what you're saying or how it can be used against you. So that's a potential major downfall pitfall of going to unemployment hearing without the assistance of counsel.
All right, number eight, failing to understand the intersection of the ADA, the MHRA, and the State of Maine FMLA. A lot of acronyms.
There are a lot of letters in there, and it's an extremely complicated subject matter because each statute, both on the federal and state level, so basically you're doubling them all, are going to have their own independent requirements, duties, obligations. And sometimes they're similar, sometimes they're not similar, sometimes they may even appear to conflict. So if you comply with the requirements of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, you may or may not have been complying with the requirements of the Maine Human Rights Act, and both of those may also have an aspect that's held dealt with differently under the Family Medical Leave Act. And perhaps an example here is that if you have an employee and they've gone out and they're qualified for Federal Family Medical Leave Act and they take time off and they use up their 12 weeks of leave for their medical time and their return to work date is approaching and you know they call you up and say, gee, you know, I've got this this problem and it's a medical problem and I really can't return to work for another 2 weeks. Employer doesn't want to hear that. Employer wants the employee to come back to work. The employer may look at the Federal Family Medical Leave Act and say, gee, your time's up. I don't have to do anything more for you. But if that person is a qualified person with a disability under the American with Disabilities Act or the Maine Human Rights Act, then you may have an obligation to provide them with a reasonable accommodation that goes beyond what's required by the Family Medical Leave Act. So if they need two more weeks to recover and come back to work, that may be a reasonable accommodation. So you can't just look at one statute and say, I've complied with it, you're gone after the 12 weeks. It's just not quite that simple.
Well, it never is really quite that simple, is it? You have to really look at every individual case and all the different parts to make sure that you're following and complying with all the different rules and regulations. This one is a big one, number nine, and again, we're talking about the top 10 employment-related mistakes. It's about misclassifying workers, and there's been a lot of talk about this over the last 2 years. The Maine Department of Labor has put out new standings having to do with 1099s, making sure that overtime is paid properly, make sure that breaks are paid properly. Where are you seeing employers getting themselves in trouble on this?
Well, I can tell you that the Department of Labor has been active in looking for employees who are misclassified as independent contractors. And there may be industries where people have been employed as independent contractors for decades. The Department of Labor comes in and says, wait, you're not really an independent contractor. You're an employee. The employer owes all kinds of back taxes for unemployment and whatever, and going forward, you're going to have to change basically the way your entire organization is structured, and it's a huge problem, and if you don't take a look at your workforce ahead of time to go through the analysis and maybe take proactive steps, you could find yourself at the end of a DOL letter, and you don't want that.
No, you certainly do not. You know, what are some of the standards, or where can somebody find the standards having to do with exempt versus non-exempt? This has been an issue where there are now specific guidelines. How do people start thinking about exempt and non-exempt in terms of an overall classification of their employees?
Well, I would say you call your lawyer first off.
No surprise to that answer.
Right. The exempt versus unexempt, that status deals with whether you're exempt from overtime or not. And there are a number of regulations under the Fair Labor Standards Act that explains exactly what the categories are and what it takes to meet those standards. So if you've got an executive or administrative or a couple other different categories of employees that have their functions, the management of the business, for example, and they're exerting control over hiring and firing and things like that. So they're actually managers or they're actually professionals and they're exerting their independent judgment, then you've met one of the prongs of being an exempt employee. But as with law, it's never that simple. There are always different prongs to meet, and you know, you also have to be paid on the salary basis. So you have to make sure that you're actually being paid or you're paying your employees a certain amount to meet that that salary base, and you're making payments properly. You're not withholding deductions for missed time. So if the person takes an afternoon off 1 week, you can't go in and deduct their wages because they took Friday afternoon off if they're a salaried employee. That could make them lose their exemption, and then you may be looking at an overtime claim.
No, it's a big area, isn't it, right now?
It is. Both of these categories, the independent contractor and the exemptions, they're complicated, and they can easily get you into trouble if you don't know what you're doing. And really, experience and perhaps outside help from counsel are the way to go, at least initially, to help you set up your categories to make sure that this position is properly exempt and that you're doing things correctly to make sure that they're stay exempt.
We're talking with John Hamer. He is a partner with the law firm of Rudman & Winchell. We're talking about top 10 employment-related mistakes. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB and presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are talking with John Hamer. He is an attorney with Rudman Winchell Law Firm up in Bangor, Maine. He's been a great guest today, and we're talking to him about top 10 employment-related mistakes. We've gone through the nine, the big nine. Now we're on number 10. Social media can be an employer's mistake. Why is that, John?
Well, because the advent of social media has created so many different problems from so many different aspects. It's also a great thing, and it can be certainly used to enhance your business, and I don't want to make it sound like you should avoid it altogether. The problem comes when an employer wants to assert control over their employees' social media. In that case, it can get you into trouble. So one of the first things you want to do is take a look and decide, do you actually want to try to regulate your employees' social media posting and so forth? Certainly, if they're posting on your behalf, you want to do that, and you'd have the right to do that. But if they're doing it on their own time, then there are certain things that you can do and there's certain things that you can't do. And since time is short, I'm going to focus on the most important one. There's under the National Labor Relations Act, anytime an employee engages in concerted activity with other employees to address their terms and benefits or conditions of work, that's going to be protected conduct or protected speech. So if you have a social media policy that attempts to regulate how employees post their social media, and it somehow chills their ability to engage in their protected Section 7 rights, then you're going to be in violation of the National Labor Relations Act, and it can be a major problem for you. There has been huge enforcement going on of these against businesses for their social media policies, so you want to make sure that whatever policy you have has been discussed thoroughly with your legal counsel.
No, you know, social media is such a vast area, and I know we've talked about it quite a bit on this show because it is such a vast area, but it is something you have to be careful about, right? You have to make sure that there's somebody who really is a spokesperson for you that is out there doing it, so that there is specific ways of making sure that it's done right for your organization, and that there are certainly a myriad of problems that could happen, from employees to background checks to everything else that goes along with it. So I know it's certainly a huge area of discussion that we've had multiple times on the show, so I completely understand. John, tell me a little bit about how long you've been in the practice, how long you've been at Redmond & Winchell, and why you enjoy it so much.
Well, I've been actually working here at Redmond & Winchell since 2008, and during that time, I have had the opportunity to work with a lot of great clients, meet a lot of great people, both inside the organization and the people we work with. It's been extremely enjoyable and very fulfilling and intellectually challenging and quite satisfying from that perspective.
No, it's a great law firm. We really appreciate them being HR Power Hour sponsors, and I think that, you know, the team up there really understands the market and understands exactly what's happening here in Maine, and I want to thank you for being a guest today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I enjoyed being here.
And now your HR tip of the week. What can a social media policy really restrict? According to Bridget Miller of TrendHR.com, there are a number of things that social media policies, generally speaking, can have in them. First, they can restrict the ability to talk publicly about anything confidential within the organization. They can control who can act on behalf of the organization in an official, public, or sanctioned capacity. They can have a policy restricting the ability to give recommendations to other employees and former employees. They can prohibit blasphemy, false claims made in bad faith. They can, of course, prohibit illegal activity. And they can prohibit from giving out information that would put the company at serious risk in any way. These are just a few of the tips, but important ones if you're thinking about a social media policy. And that's your HR tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Laura Lavovich of the Career Strategy Group will be talking about her new book, 100 Conversations for Career Success. Laura started out as a resume writer and now has a team of resume writing professionals in the Metro DC area. She's going to be talking about this book, You Get to Learn from the Best. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.